And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And we have a fun show for you this evening. We've got Ben Hansen. He is going to be in for the first part of the show. It's always great speaking with him. He's a great guy. And I can't wait to talk to him about his new show on the Travel Channel. And it's regarding ghosts. We will touch on UFOs a little too in there. I will promise you that. And then in hour two, we have Walter Bosley on, and he's going to be talking about UFOs. He lives out in the San Bernardino, Southern California. I can't remember I'm not positive of the name of the town he lives in, but anyway, we'll be talking about UFOs in California and UFOs in general. He has a thought that a lot of what people are seeing in military are going to be talking about that as well. And and we'll be taking calls on the new screening number. And I'll be going over that in the second hour. The phone number will be up on the screen for YouTube. And over at KGRA Radio, that number will be put in the chat room over there. So you have that. And I want to thank everyone that supports the show. Anyone can do that, and that's over at podcastufo.com. And while you're there, check out the blog this week. It's called Maury Island Madness by Charles Lear. And yes, there was a madness in the Maury Island situation. So for now, I guess we're going to start the show with UFO news with the one and only Alejandro Rojas. How are you, Alejandro?
Hello.
How's it going?
How are you doing?
Good. So what is happening? You were at Roswell.
In sync there.
Yeah.
Oh, we're still in sync. We're in sync. We keep starting our comments at the same time. Now we're out.
You go ahead.
Yeah. I was in Roswell.
Yeah.
So peace to Earthlings. I just came from Roswell, where I originally landed over, 60 years ago?
Yeah, 1947. July, somewhere around July 6th or 5th, yeah?
Yeah, so July 2nd, actually, is the semi-official date of the crash. I didn't know this, because that date has been in dispute, and the news came on. I was actually on a local news on July 2nd for World UFO Day, and she was like, yeah, it's for, the crash of the Roswell craft. And I was like, well, I don't think so, because it wasn't the 2nd. And then later she's like, yeah, it was. And I felt like a total doofus because I'm supposed to be this expert. And but that date has been debated by, I know, the big guy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know. Just too much in the weeds. But yeah, Roswell was a lot of fun. A ton of people there. It was also, although it was fun, it was also a bit nostalgic in that we, talked about Stanton quite a bit, Stan Friedman, because we all wouldn't have been there if it wasn't for Stanton. And so at times a bit sad, but also kind of celebratory of his life, because he was so well loved by everyone there and by the Roswell Museum, who hosted the event and everything. So it was a lot of fun. A ton of people came through as usual. And the newspaper actually covered both of my talks, and then I submitted for them an article. So I posted those links also in the news for the Roswell Daily Record. And I guess I'll get into the news, because what I wrote in that article was regarding some of this news, which is essentially how UFOs are becoming a hot topic in Washington, D.C. So we've heard that, a couple different senators have claimed to be briefed on UFOs. So while we were out in Roswell, which is so strange, to think that the festival is the same as usual, people buying their UFO shirts, the alien costume contest for the animals and humans going on, and the parade where people dress really funny and kind of celebrate kind of the weirdness of the alien thing. Meanwhile, we're at the museum sharing credible information. And meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., the president is getting grilled by Fox News about UFOs. So that was really interesting. Some of you might have seen this. Tucker Carlson of Fox News, of course, has been talking about UFOs and interviewing Lou Elizondo and David Fravor and some of the other people, government people or pilots who have talked about UFO sightings. And he obviously seems finds this information very compelling. Well, he asked President what he felt about the UFOs, and the president said, well, I don't really believe in them, but you never know. And Tucker Carlson pushed him on one of the things Elizondo told him that was shocking, which was, they said there's even material from a crashed UFO. And the president said, well, I haven't heard anything like that. I don't know about that, but you never know.
Yeah.
And I think personally that the president's telling the truth here, that his short briefing, which is he didn't even call it a briefing. He said his brief meeting from the Navy on UFOs was about these Navy pilots. And that seems to be all they told him. So they might not have told him about this other stuff, although he did tell Tucker Carlson he's seen some of his shows on that. And we all know he watches Fox News a lot. So no doubt he has seen some of these interviews. But at least what he's been given so far doesn't seem compelling to him. But I think the bigger story for those of us who do this and have been doing this for so long is that the president is talking about UFOs and being asked about them, not in a tongue-in-cheek manner, but in a serious manner.
Yeah.
And it shows that this topic is taken seriously in Washington and the mainstream media at this point, which is, you know, quite remarkable, I think.
I think so, too. And the other big news with that is, that the president might have been telling the truth.
Exactly. Boy. That's shocking as well.
I think I'm going to get some mail.
Yeah, I wasn't going to go there, but because I know you get a lot of mail whenever we allude to the president, even
like,
if we're not saying anything critical, we get mail.
That's
but
true.
Now you're going to get a heap of it.
Yeah. I'll just put the
spin block. Speaking of politics, though, this is really interesting. A YouGov poll that was done recently that most Americans in this result of this poll believe the government is hiding info about UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not too surprising. We've seen this before, but it's a large percentage. So they say in their stats, 54% of Americans believe the government knows something about UFOs that's not being shared with the public. Now, there is a caveat to that. What they said was the question they asked, how likely or unlikely do you believe it is that the government knows something about UFOs that's not being shared with the public? So the total average, because here's the answers you could give: very likely, somewhat likely, somewhat unlikely, very unlikely, or don't know. So with that 54%, they grouped the very likely and the somewhat likely. 28% said it was very likely the government's hiding something. 26% said somewhat likely. So I think that's kind of an important distinction. And then 19 said, I don't know. This is sort of interesting, though. Democrats, more than Republicans, believe that something's being hidden. So 62% of the Democrats as opposed to 51% of the Republicans. I don't know what to make of that whatsoever, to be honest.
Right.
I would have thought the opposite, actually. So that's kind of interesting because, of course, Republicans are more kind of, I don't know if I'd say anti-government. I don't, in a way that's true, but it's more, they're kind of more, they want the government to stay out of their business.
Right, less control.
So I would have thought the Republicans would have felt that way more so.
Mm-hmm.
But the group that believed this the least were the independents. The independents felt less likely.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So pretty interesting. And then finally, this is also interesting. I think this is really weird. The 45 to 54 age group was the most likely to believe in government secrets by a large percentage. So it's about 65% even of the 45 to 54% group. However, the 18 to 24 year olds were the least likely at only like 41%, and only 10% of the 18 to 24 thought it was very likely the government's hiding something. What's strange about that is the 18 to 24 is the age group that by far believes that aliens are here and aliens exist.
Or listen to these shows. A lot of them listen to the, you know, demographically, yeah, listen to these shows.
Podcasts and stuff. Mm-hmm. So they very much think that aliens are real, and I think that UFOs are real, but they don't think the government knows much. And honestly, and I think you feel the same way, that that's likely true. I think they're not giving the government the credit that that for some reason older people give the government. Like the government is somehow all-knowing and has all the answers, even though we don't trust them to be able to tie their shoes. Somehow they have all the secrets and have been able to keep it from us. It seems like the younger folks don't buy that, that they think that the government is just as much in the dark as the rest of us when it comes to this topic.
Right, right.
And I'm impressed with those young whippersnappers for believing that. I think they're right.
That's pretty amazing. Well, hey, our guest just called in. And
oh, really? He's early.
He's early. That's cool, though. Yeah.
I want to talk some more.
All right. Go ahead.
No, I'm finish kidding. Is it, yeah. Your guest is Ben, right?
Ben Henson, yes.
Yeah.
The one and only.
Guy. He's a good buddy.
Yeah. All right, Alejandro, thanks so much. Well, say hi to him. You could say hi.
Hey, Ben.
How's it going?
Doing good, doing good. Congratulations on the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a while since we chatted.
I know. It has been a while. You've been busy shooting with your shooting your cool show. But I guess the last piece is that, of course, everybody can go see all of this latest news on the front page of openminds.tv if you want to see more of the latest. There's a lot of UFO news these days. And Ben, have you been keeping up with the news? Because your show is about ghost hunting.
You know, it's been so hard. It's been really hard because it keeps coming out so fast. Most of my news is if I get a chance to read your summaries and articles, that's like all I'm able to do. You know, it's like one day after the next. Oh, Trump's going to say something. Oh, Luis Elizondo did this or did that. And it's just so hard to keep up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. A lot of things happen. It's hard for me to keep up.
Yeah.
There was something I said recently and not too long ago, and Jeremy Corbell's like, no, in my interview, you'll see that this happened back then. I'm like, oh, sorry, dude. I didn't even... There's just so much information. So it's helpful that lots of other people are involved in this and everything. And I guess we're just going to have to hook up at some point soon, Ben, and I'll get you up to speed.
Yeah, download it all on me because it's unless you're in this full time, you know, like some of us are, it's too hard to keep a day job and to stay up on it, you know. And people expect you to give them the summaries of what's important. You know, so it's a full-time job, whether you like it or not.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I just recently, that was one of my talks in Roswell, was getting people up to speed on all of this. And so there were some people who recorded, and I know. So as soon as that comes up, I'll share that on my social media and I'll send it to you, Ben.
Okay.
Alejandro, thanks so much.
Yes, thank you. Have a great show, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
All right, take care.
I'm good.
Ben, welcome to the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's always great talking to you, whether it's here or in person or whatever. It's always fun. And
so I have a fancy microphone like Alejandro, but I'm talking to you from my laptop at the moment. Because I had to refresh everything. So when you take your first commercial break, maybe you'll switch over. And
sure, yeah. Yeah, and that'll be at about 8 minutes from now. We're going to be doing that.
Okay.
So, all right, excellent. So for the person that is not familiar with you, you have an FBI background. You have a very interesting background. And I normally wouldn't, you know, have you go through all this, but we have so many new listeners to the show. If you wouldn't mind, and also talk about your the show that a lot of people may recognize you from, Fake or Fact, or did I say it the back? Did I say it the
Fact or Fake backwards? Yeah,
yeah, Fact or Fake, yeah, yeah. So go ahead, if you would talk about your background and all that, please.
Okay. Sure. So my first love, I guess you could say, of these unusual subjects was UFOs. And I was probably, 5 years old when E.T. came out. And yeah. Like a lot of people, your first kind of introduction to it, you know, is through movies. Mm-hmm. And so I was a kid, you know, read a lot of books, and my parents encouraged me. They would buy me things far beyond my reading level, and I would collect newspaper articles, and I was just fascinated. The 80s, you know, when we had print newspapers, you would see stuff come out, and then if you didn't clip it out and save it, it was gone. It was so hard to search things. So I had a you know, thick stack of articles of UFO things. So I got older, you know, I kind of put it away because the subject kind of scared me. I didn't know what to do with it. I believed it was possible and that we've been visited. And it wasn't until I was in, I was in college on, I was working in Florida and was there for the summer doing pest control. And on my way home, my friend and I decided to take a little cruise over the Bahamas. And it was just an overnight thing. And on that ship, one night as we're out looking at the stars, we saw an object that was doing S-turns and moving incredibly fast. And it kind of got me initiated and excited about it.
Hmm.
And when I graduated college, I went to work. My degree was in sociology and criminology. Went to work for the state of Utah investigating child sex crimes, severe physical abuse cases. So it's not like the greatest party discussion when you bring that up. But so the end goal was to work for federal law enforcement, which I did. I worked for the FBI. I don't describe myself as a veteran by any means. I was there just for a couple years, but it wasn't what I expected. And, you know, I would say the greatest part about it, though, is the training and most of the people I worked with really gave me a chance to kind of like, refine skills I already had, but to be able to look at something objectively, which I think this field is sometimes lacking quite a bit of, and we don't question, because it's so anecdotal. You know, I tell people all the time, it's experiential. It's almost like a religion. Ufology,
mm-hmm.
which is good and bad because we're very accepting, but my background in law enforcement kind of helped me separate the emotion, the feeling of it all with, okay, well, let's look at the facts. Are we trying to convince people? What are we trying to do here? And how can we best do that? And so I got into TV world sort of by accident. I was kind of connected to a production company that was looking to do a TV show about paranormal, but they didn't have any idea of what they wanted to do. And so I had a group that we did mostly ghost hunting just kind of for fun on the side. But I said, look, it was really cool because being in the ground level, I said, if you guys only do ghosts, because ghost hunting was big at that time, like it is now. I said, if you only do ghosts, you're missing out. There's a huge interest in UFOs. There's mm-hmm. a huge interest in Bigfoot. And we devised a show, I would say probably about 80% of my input, which turned into what became Fact or Fake Paranormal Files on the Sci-Fi Channel. And it went for 3 seasons. 6 of us would go out. It was sort of like a cross between Mythbusters and, you know, like Ghost Hunters and UFO Hunters. And the premise was take what people are claiming at face value and say, okay, before we start the case, what do you have for us? Is it interesting enough that we can test your experience or test what you claim to have captured? And that's how it went. So we do experiments, and it was really fun. I mean, we went all over the world.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that show very much. And anyone, I think you can still find episodes of it, right?
I believe Destination America bought the rights to mm-hmm. it to show it, and then I think Travel was showing reruns. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So Discovery owns it now on reruns, and you can probably find it on YouTube.
Yeah, we're going to go into break in about 3 minutes or so, but
okay.
And then we're going to talk about your new show at that time. But I want to just ask you about this particular show that you were in the beginning, because I do remember that you actually found some people that were actually fraudulent, and they were fake. And one of them comes to mind when that, let's see, the UFO in the forest were the, I think that it supposedly killed the guy's dog and all that. And that was kind of
the
a
Jonathan Reed case.
Yeah. Yeah. But you kind of called that guy out, really, didn't you, on that particular show?
Yeah, in the beginning, we probably had more cases that were unexplained. But as we got in the second, third season, we have people coming to us, and a lot of them just wanted FaceTime. They wanted, you know, some of them were scammers. And his actually, Stan Freeman did quite a bit of work on that case. And so most people regarded it as a fake. However, there were so many people who were still in his camp that I decided to, hey, let's look at it objectively. He claims to have good video evidence, and we called him out.
And there's still people, and there people kind of attacked you for doing that, right? And there's still people that back him 100%, even with all the evidence right there, which is really bizarre.
There are, and, and it's sad because we don't want to be that type of person to go after our own. But if we don't, you know, how do we maintain credibility?
Yeah, I think it's important. I really do think it's important, and you know, that's why, you know, I've made a couple of enemies by calling out a few people on YouTube and stuff like that, you know. But, you know, if people are looking for the right information, they're just going to get turned off and go away and not have any interest in it at all once they find, you know, third phase of the moon. I understand Secure Team 10, he's trying to clean up his act a little bit. I'm not really sure. You know, that's what I keep hearing from people. But if people go there for source, you know, they're going to be discouraged as soon as they find out that it's fake, and then they'll just go away from the whole UFO topic and won't have any interest in it. I've just seen enough of that happen in my life in different ways. So we're going to be right back right after these messages. All right, welcome back to the show. My guest tonight for this first hour is Ben Hansen. Ben, so where were we when we went to break? You know, it's a funny thing. I usually write things down.
I think we were talking about
people that you found that were fake. And before we move on from basically that topic, were there some other like major sightings or things that are they're really well known that, you know, actually you found there was, you know, could not be reproduced or, you know, you kind of did it sort of in a scientific manner, right?
Yeah, so we like taking on a couple historic cases. One of them that comes to mind is the Rex Heflin case.
Oh, yes.
That took place here in, I guess it was Santa Ana, Tustin area in California. And, I wanted to believe that case, and it's still the jury's kind of out on it. But it followed kind of some patterns that were typical, you know, where the story, I call it legendizing. I do a lecture on hoaxers. And what happened in the Heflin case that wasn't on the show was a mutual friend of ours. I'm sure you know Bob Kiviat. He was working on our show as a producer. And he was doing Unsolved Mysteries, I think, way back in the day. Anyways, when Rex was alive, he reached out to him to get these photos. For people who don't know, Rex Heflin, he was a construction worker that worked on roadways. And he was out with his truck. And this is back in the day when there weren't even orchards in Orange County, California. It was desolate. And he's out by the Toro, I think Del Toro Air Force Base, El Toro. And he sees this object as he's there on the side of this dirt road. He sees an object hovering, classic saucer shape. So he takes out his Polaroid camera and he snaps off, I think it was 4 or 5 photos with a Polaroid. And as this thing comes over his truck and then leaves sort of like a ring of smoke towards the end of it. And his story was one of the first where we hear, aside from maybe Roswell going back a little earlier, of the Men in Black sort of thing going on. He took these photos, and within I can't remember how many days or weeks, two men in black suits show up to his house, say they're from the government. They want the photos. So they say they're going to borrow them. I think they said they're from NORAD. I can't remember. Wanted to borrow them and then didn't return them. And he claims that they took them back or something. I can't remember how it went. But Bob Kiviat was doing, I think, this Unsolved Mystery show, and he reaches out to him and is like, hey, they want to do your episode, but we need those photos. And he says, well, they took them back again or something like that. And lo and behold, like a week later, he calls up Bob and says, oh, they just showed up in the mail. Someone put them in my mailbox and the photos are back. Mm-hmm. And so that was my thing. It's like, well, very, very coincidental. We were able to kind of recreate using pie tins and some other things. It's kind of how I feel about Billy Meier case. You know, if it looks like a saucer, like a pie tin, feels like one, you know, it's kind of like you're already kind of leaning towards it not being, you want it to be true, but we weren't able to really substantiate either way on that case. We're kind of mixed, you know.
Now, aren't the original photos in I'm trying to remember the woman that's so well known in Southern California, she has those in her safe, I believe her daughter said. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't. That must have come up after maybe we did the episode, because when we were doing the show, we didn't have access to the originals, and Bob, I'm sure, would have known about it.
Yeah,
that would be great.
but I do remember the thing about what you said about them showing up in the mailbox after so many years. You know, I do remember that part. So yeah, that's a tricky one. So tell us what you're up to now in this new Travel Channel show.
So yeah, I've been over the, you know, last several years, I've been doing guest appearances here and there. A combination of ghost hunting shows, UFO appearances. We did a real fun one on Smithsonian years ago that was called UFOs Declassified. And then I helped work on one that recently aired on the CW called Roswell Decoded. And I think they got picked up for more episodes. And finally, you know, kind of doing this here and there, helping people, another opportunity came along. They said, hey, you know, ghost hunting is hot again. We all thought people were going to kind of take a break from it, but it's come back a little bit even stronger than it was before. And
really?
It's we could talk for hours about that and why I think that's the case. I'm actually working with some professors from Chapman on doing a sociological study on this.
Wow.
But it's back. And if you look on A&E Travel and a little bit of history, between those three networks, they're pretty much buying up everything that's paranormal. So that would include UFOs, a lot of ghost hunting, some Bigfoot things are coming back. And, you know, kind of cycles like this until I think the market gets saturated and then you see what's left over. Only the best shows survive.
Yeah.
So I was filming for about 3.5 months down in Louisiana in a parish called St. Mary Parish. That's like their counties there. And a lot of fun. We're working with local police departments who actually get calls. People call 911. They call the police departments, you know, saying there's somebody in my house, but I don't think it's human. There's things going on I can't explain. And the police are really in a great position because it's a tight-knit community. They don't just dismiss what people tell them. You know, and they'll go out, but they're puzzled. They don't know what to do. So we've been hand in hand responding to these calls that the police get down there in St. Mary Parish and trying to figure it out.
And there's a lot going on in that particular area, which is really quite interesting in itself. you know, when it comes to like a hotspot type of thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you know anything about what happened after Katrina, my friend Bill Murphy, who did was my co-host on Factor Fake, he did a documentary on it. And just the haunted area of New Orleans, what became of it after Katrina, seemed to almost, I don't know, reactivate things. And you had so much tragedy and trauma that you layer that sort of like, like an onion, right? You put that on top of the Civil War, on top of the Yellow Fever, on top of the pirates and all the things that they had going on there. And you have layers upon layers of very rich history in Louisiana. And then currently, you've got the Cajun, you know, and Creole cultures that are very superstitious.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like the perfect mix of a very active location.
Wow. Wow. Now, I saw the trailer on that. I saw you out in a boat. I'm a real boat type of guy. I was boating today. So anything on the boat, I would love to do. But so why are you out in this boat? I mean, and there was someone else in another boat, I believe. Are things happening on the water?
So I'm going to have to go. I know what episode's coming up, but I actually haven't seen the newest trailer. It probably came out today. So this Friday, it's like 9 p.m., 8 p.m. Central on Travel Channel. It's an episode where we went out to a call that somebody had seen two guys hoisting what looks like some sort of a treasure chest. Okay, now there's an island out there in the bayou that's it's kind of a privately owned secret sort of a place, because that's where they filmed part of the TV show Naked and Afraid. It's way out there, and so as we're out exploring, we came into contact with an eyewitness to, I guess you would call it sort of like an entity. The way I pictured it was sort of like Predator. There's like something out there lurking on the island that he experienced while he was filming the TV show, and it scared him so badly that he and the woman that was there with him were pretty traumatized for years. And so we explore that and the history of the island, and we're out there on those boats, and the alligators had not quite woken up yet. This was like April when we were filming. Uh-huh. So we wanted to see, and we only saw a couple because it's got to get warm enough, but there were all sorts of creepy things out there.
Wow. That's pretty awesome. So is each episode different as far as, you know, a certain case and a certain investigation? Is that what the episodes are?
Yeah, so it follows, because we're there working, they're not standalone episodes, because we're actually in the same location the whole time, whereas Factor Fake was more what we call a magazine-style show, you know, where we'd get a case and we'd go, who knows, across the world. These cases do have links, because our whole goal was to try and help the local police departments try to figure out if there's an overall connection, you know, if it's just random, or if there's actually something going on that might have intensified all the sightings. And so they follow in sequence. I mean, you can tune in one week and you don't have to know what happened necessarily the week before.
I see.
But it's all in the same general area.
Yeah. So as far as your thoughts on, you know, it's kind of, I think there is something to this, because I actually had an experience myself, being in the antiques business, cleaning out a house. I had something happen once that was just totally unexplainable, but it really happened. It happened right in front of me.
And what'd you see?
I didn't see anything, but a door slammed in a room where all the windows were down, and the door had to be dragged across the carpet to open, because they never lowered they never cut the bottom of the door when they installed the carpet. And that just slammed shut. And there was three things happened that day, one, you know, right after the other, basically. So it was actually something did it, and there was something had to make that happen. So there is something there. There's something to it. But is it just like UFOs, like we see that they're there, but we have no idea what they are? Is it? I mean, do you think it's the same way? How do you approach it?
I think what you might be getting to, and what I think a lot of, there's some hesitation with some of these, I don't want to call them, well, what would you call them? Genres. They're not really industries, studies. You've got cryptozoology, right? And you got UFOs, and you got what people call the paranormal, but the ghost stuff. And I think there's a lot more crossover. And I think that, you know, when we finally realize what's going on, you're seeing in the UFO field, people are becoming more open to this interdimensional sort of a thing.
Yeah.
And so with the spirits and the ghosts, I do think there is a other dimension, if you want to call it that, where they're not always visible to us, but they're present. And I don't know if they can always see us, just like we can't always see them, but they can kind of slip in and out. Right. And so they can physically manipulate things. And as crazy as that sounds, without having hard evidence of it, it's like your story. Like, I can only tell you what I've seen. I can tell you I've seen objects fly across the room. I can tell you we've had equipment, you know, slammed on the ground right in front of us.
Hmm.
You know, I've seen, you know, shadow figures walk right through a wall. I've heard voices in my ear. So, you know, how could these things be physically manipulating our world if it didn't have some physicality to it?
Right. Yeah.
So I think that there is probably a connection there when we talk about UFOs and how these physical objects are causing physical interactions with the ground, with trace evidence, but it's not always there. And therefore, do we really need to even discuss how they got here from thousands of light years away when we talk about interdimensional? There's all sorts of possibilities.
Right, right. Another thing you do is you do a lot with night vision and, you know, things like that. So this question I want to ask you pertains to this in a roundabout way. And I've said it a couple times on the show that we only see a certain spectrum. You know, there's only, and we only know so much of what is actually going around us, on around us, and a lot of stuff we just can't experience or see. Do you think that some of this has to do with that another spectrum as well, or possibility?
I do, and I think that's why we eventually, I think technology will capture, we call it the smoking gun, but I don't think technology is going to convince people who don't want to be convinced, but I do think that we're getting to the point where we're able to start seeing into what we might call another dimension because our physical eyes can't see there yet. And so, for example, night vision sees a little bit into the infrared, but we also have cameras we use in ghost hunting that see into the ultraviolet. They're full spectrum cameras. Then we have the long wave infrared that sees heat signatures, the thermal cameras. And so when I do these sky watches, I'm telling people, look, You got your night vision, that's great. If you got the money, you might want to look into thermal, because I have filmed triangular objects, silent triangle objects, out in Utah, actually, near Skinwalker Ranch, that didn't show up. Didn't show up with it. I couldn't see them with my physical eyes, but they're clearly there in the thermal camera. So it's picking up a heat signature. And so whatever technology is being used to cloak them, we're able to see with some of these cameras to see their signatures.
Wow, amazing. The next guest I have coming on is just before I did a sound check with him, and so he'll be on coming up right after you. But he said he thinks, you know, a lot of UFOs are 90% of them are military. And I said, well, I'm going to argue with you about that. And he says, well, he goes, I don't do debates. But anyway, I said, well, no, we'll discuss it. But, you know, there's a lot of people that do speculate that, and a lot of people are saying, you know, with this Tic Tac, you know, in the Nimitz case, there's speculation that that might be some type of military or secret government project or whatever. But, you know, I still think, and I think most people that really, really look into it sort of agree, or that there's just too many things going on with them to be even advanced technology, you know, I mean, the things that they, you know, defy.
Yeah.
So,
I tend to agree with that. I mean, the things that I've lived in Huntington Beach, California, and the object that I saw fly from the ocean, over the high school, running track where I was completely silent, 1,000 feet. And after I recovered from the whole shock of seeing this thing, this triangle that didn't have any underside. It was like transparent. I thought, okay, well, whose is it? And I thought, well, if you are trying to keep it a secret, if it's ours, you don't fly it over a heavily populated area unless you're trying to test the reactions.
Yeah. There's a theory about that. Yes. Yeah, I've heard that.
Right? Mm-hmm. That they're just so brazen now. They're like, hey, we'll do what we want because no one believes it, or, you know, the desensitization theory. But I'm not quite sure, because the bottom line, I guess probably what Alejandro talked about a lot about Elizondo, to the Stars Academy, the shows and all, everything coming out. The bottom line for me, what I'm learning from it, is more and more, I don't think our government has a clue.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah. people that are longtime listeners to the show have heard me say that many times. And I think I totally agree with you. And, you know, I think they're just as puzzled as we are. But I do believe that there's enough evidence out there to show that they've actually gathered, you know, say, film clips and things mm-hmm. like that, you know, and kept them away from the public. But I think, you know, there's definitely a fear on their side if they can't, you know, protect us from whatever it is, or they don't know what it is, to say that, you know, there's something invading our skies and we don't know what it is. They can't say that. I mean, I don't think that would fly too well, so to speak.
It benefits them nothing. And if you look at it as a exchange, you know, of knowledge and power, that it doesn't benefit them anything to give up their cards to show they have nothing.
Right.
You know, like I wouldn't doubt if we've, you know, maybe back engineered some of it, and we have some maybe workable models perhaps that we're starting to fly and experiment with, but I don't think they have a handle on who is visiting, and, you know, at will, they're just kind of coming and going. So it's frustrating, because you would just rather them say, okay, we get it. You don't understand. We already don't trust the government like we used to.
Yeah.
So just come out and tell us. Let's just all get on the same playing field. Maybe by doing that, you have some of the brightest minds out there who, you know, could jump in here, and we could start gearing our universities and taking this information that we do have and get everybody working on it. I mean,
yeah.
I really think you're wasting resources there when you compartmentalize things so drastically, because you, what, can't trust people, you can't control the technology that comes out of it. You know, everyone, we all live on this planet.
Yeah.
we all are entitled to this information.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I do this at the beginning of every show. I do an intro that has people talking over, you know, the music. And one of them, I think the very last clip in that is you actually talking about your grandfather. And so I know you've told this on this show a few different times, but if you wouldn't mind, for the person that's never heard you talk before, can you tell the story about your grandfather and your father?
Yeah.
Love that.
So
we have about 5 minutes just to let you know. Yeah,
okay, sounds good. So I grew up in Utah primarily, and my grandfather and my dad's father, he worked at Hill Air Force Base. He served in the Army in World War II, and from about 1950 to 1980, he worked at Hill Air Force Base as a civilian technician and engineer. And about 1965, he came to my dad and told him, he said, son, I've been called to be part of a special team, and they could call me at a moment's notice. And he's 15 at the time, 14, 15. He said, you're in charge. You know, like, you got to take care of mom and your sisters. And he says, well, where are you going? He's like, well, I won't be able to tell you where I'm going or when I'm coming back. And he says, well, okay, is it like a nuclear war thing? And he said, something like that. So the summer of 1965 was the first time he got a call. They took him to the airport. He takes off. He comes back a couple weeks later. So this went on and off for years. He knows specifically many times he was called to Wright-Patterson Air Force. So for those who don't know, that's the head of the Foreign Technology Division of the Air Force. That's where the Roswell debris, we know a lot of it went there. It was head of Project Blue Book. And my dad didn't really think much of it other than the fact that he couldn't get a hold of Grandpa and he was working underground. We knew that. His specialty was hangar systems. And fast forward to 1994, I believe it was, or 95, he had cancer. And it spread to his pancreas, eventually to his brain. And in his final weeks and months, my dad would go to the gym with him a lot and would they were watching Unsolved Mysteries. They enjoyed doing that together. And he started questioning because this is when Roswell stuff started coming out. And he said, "Hey, Dad, like you were there. Do you know this guy Philip Corso claims to this all seeing this and that? Do you know about this?" And Grandpa would just kind of sit there and he would say, that's interesting. And there's some things he'd say, "Oh, that's completely ridiculous." Well, one day they're at the gym and he says, "Dad, I have to know." He's like, I know you're getting on in years. I don't know how long you're going to be here. Ben and I really are into this subject. I need to know, are we alone?" He got up out of the gym and he looked at him. He said, "It's time to leave." He stormed off. How much time we got? Like 2 minutes? 1 minute? He walked away. And he knew that he had hit a subject that he didn't want to talk about. And so it wasn't brought up again, really, until he was on his deathbed. And he's there in the hospital. And I was supposed to go meet him there. And I was on a date. And when I got done with my date, I called him up and he said, "Grandpa, your grandpa passed away already." And I was really sad that I wasn't there. But years later, he said, the final moments, he was holding my hand. And he turned to me and he said, "Son, I know what you've been asking me." And he said, "I want you to know not to be afraid, but we're not alone." Yeah. And he knew he wasn't talking about ghosts. He wasn't talking about the afterlife. He said, "Take care of your mother. It's going to be okay." Wow. You know, and so we have kind of been on this journey because we wanted to know what Grandpa knew. And did he leave us clues? And what did he see? You know, whatever work he was involved with.
Wow. So I love, you know, I've heard the story a number of times. I love hearing it every time. It's a great one. And well, I believe didn't you say that during the Kecksburg he may have been gone too?
Yeah, we actually I believe it was August, or no, it was December. Kecksburg was December of, I want to say, it was 65.
I'm bad with
anyways
numbers.
we traced it to that exact weekend.
Yeah,
that he went disappearing.
How about that? Yeah.
And we know that Kecksburg debris, there were witnesses that said they brought it to Wright-Patterson through the back gate. And suddenly Grandpa, the next, you know, day, has got a call and he's got to leave to Wright-Patterson.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Great stuff. All right, Ben. So we're ready to sign off here for the break. And we'll be saying goodbye to you and bringing on our new guest. So if you would, please let everyone know the show. And it's already premiered. It premiered a few weeks ago, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But can you let everyone know when
sure.
and where so they can catch that?
It's Ghosts of Morgan City. It's on Travel Channel. And episode 4 is coming up this Friday. We have 8 episodes. It's 9 p.m., 8 p.m. Central. Travel Channel. You can also watch it on the Travel Channel Go app. I think it's what it's called. And they're streaming on there if you want to tune in later. But it's a lot of fun, and thanks for having me on.
Excellent. All right. Always great to talk to you, Ben.
You too. Thanks, Martin.
All right. Take care. All right, everyone. So hang in. We'll be right back. Welcome back, and you can see my guest right here with me now is Walter Bosley. Welcome to the show, Walter.
Thanks for having me on, Martin. I'm looking forward to our talk.
Yes, and you're in Southern California, and it's probably pretty hot out there right now. You had a little shake going on there a couple days ago, right?
Yeah, which is characteristic of this kind of weather. When traditionally, when we have long stretches of dry, hot weather, we get into earthquakes. But we haven't had the because we've had pretty much a cool, wet year through most of this year until we hit the summer, and the heat has come back, engines, and brought with it the earthquakes. So yeah, it's kind of a scorcher outside today a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. The one thing I think is it seems like it's getting worse out there. You know, I might be totally wrong about it, is the fires that are happening out there are just terrible. And, it just seems like it gets worse every year. Maybe I'm wrong.
Right. Well, when we do get hit with the fires, they seem to be a particularly breed of nasty about them. And that's because we had drought. We had these spells of drought
That's
for
right.
so long that there was yeah. so much dry. But then, fireworks, for instance, private fireworks are illegal in my community because of this. And there's a lot of communities in Southern California where they're illegal. And, unfortunately, you get those young dads who want to show off to the kids. And there they are popping those things off. And everybody just kind of holds their finger, crosses their fingers that it won't start a fire. So
yeah,
it is dangerous out here.
Yeah. I was in Northern California. I told you I've lived there for 9 years, and it was very dry summer, and we had the most unusual thing. It never happens. All of a sudden there was a thunderstorm. That never happens there in the middle of the summer. And I actually physically watched a lightning bolt go down and hit the hill, and a fire, you could see the fire start immediately.
Yeah. Wow.
It was just right in front of my eyes. It was really amazing.
Gets your attention.
Yeah. So for the person who has never heard of you, seen you before, I know you've got a lot going on. You wrote a book, too. We can talk about that. But please give us your background and what gets you interested in this sort of off-topic, as some people might call it.
Well, I grew up interested in these weird things. Of course, UFOs were among the first earliest interests from the time I was a kid. Found it fascinating, and along with spooky stories of the paranormal and such like that. Grew up a big fan of horror films. My dad raised me on those things, and started having, everybody has their weird experiences. Mine really kicked in at around 16 years old, and I started my professional career in the late 80s with the FBI. And even with my weird interests, I made it through the background and got hired.
Wow.
And learned that there's a lot of other people with the same weird interest in national security. So I was with the FBI as a counterintelligence operative for a few years, almost six. And then I earned my commission in the Air Force and spent all my active duty time as a special agent of the Air Force OSI for about 6 years. And then after that, I went into counterterrorism stuff, working globally all around the world. And through all of this, I still maintained my interests and, did my personal study and research on weird things. And after leaving counterterrorism, I had started a publishing company a few years before that. But after leaving the counterterrorism work, I devoted myself to writing, and I just earlier this year finished and published my 10th nonfiction book.
Wow.
So, and yeah, they cover a gamut of things from kind of alternative archaeology to occult murder and the esoteric engineering of Disneyland, which was my first nonfiction book, and a book about my dad's weird experiences in the Air Force. And secret space program, breakaway civilization stuff. So an interesting gamut of subjects that actually have threads that tie them together in many ways.
Wow, that's interesting. I do want to ask you more about your dad's Air Force experience in a minute, but I think this is kind of ironic because I didn't know about your FBI experience, and you're the second guest tonight that is former FBI and from Southern California, Ben Hansen as well. So Yeah, that is ironic and pretty amazing. So along those lines, I've talked to Ben many times about this, that, the background, his FBI background really, gives him an edge. And actually, it sounds like you agree already.
Oh, absolutely. Because now I recall Ben's a former agent, right? He was the one of the specialists on, was it UFO Hunters?
Oh, yes, he was on Fact and Fact or Faked.
Yes, that's what it was. Fact or Faked. I remember he was on there. And absolutely, you know, his experience as an agent there, my experience as an agent, you know, that I had, you know, you learn the basics of real, practical, real world investigating, you know, investigations. And you can apply that to these subjects very well, I think. So,
yeah,
definitely. It's a good skill.
Right, right. One of his skills was actually watching body language and, you know, trying to, you know, during interviews to see if people are telling the truth. And he's done a lot of a video analysis of that that's pretty fascinating, especially when it comes to former presidents. He's done a few of those, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. That's interesting to see that analysis when they're talking about that stuff.
That's right, yeah. He told me he spent 40 hours on, I think it was an 8-minute clip of Obama on Jimmy Kimmel when it came to UFOs. Mm-hmm. He spent that much time trying to analyze that, which is fascinating. So you said you had your experience at 16. Can you go into that? What happened?
Well, that was in the realm of a personal illumination, awakening kind of thing. I simply woke up one Sunday morning during Christmas break, 1979, and looked at my hands. And my thought was, these are not my hands. You know, I'm looking around now. Now, I want you to know something. I'm the quintessential nerd, okay? I'm probably one of four people you know who's never even taken a puff of weed. All right. Much less any recreational drug. So, no, I was not, you know, a recreational drug user. I was quite the nerd, the dork, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so that was not in the equation here. This was all an organic thing coming from the psyche. And that opened up a period in my life where all manner of things kind of came to the forefront and were I noticed things more intensely. Be it what I would later learn were synchronicities you know, sensing presences, just kind of a grab bag of weird psychic things and experiences, which I did not begin to understand really until my mentor started working with me. And I found out that he was, you know, kind of learned in these things, and he, you know, would talk with me about them and just kind of help me develop my understanding.
So he basically had an open mind is what I'm he let
me?
You, yes.
Oh,
no,
God.
no.
Oh,
he
my
your mentor? Yes.
Oh, yes, my mentor. My mentor was the first person to tell me about what we now know as remote viewing in 1986. And he took me outside one day. We had to go out to his van to get something out of there, some file that he needed out of there. He's an uncle of mine. He's one of my mom's older brothers. So we walk outside, and we're standing there on the sidewalk, and he points up to a hill, the foothills here of the San Bernardino Mountains, and he says, see that hill up there? One of these days you'll be trained how to be standing down here on the street and throw your mind, your consciousness, up on top of that hill and tell your team what's up there real time as you see it. You know, and you know, it's 1986. I'm a young guy right out of college, and this is some really wild stuff, and I'm just a rapt audience. You know, I'm listening to this thinking, wow, that's pretty cool. And 10 years later, you know, by then I was in the Air Force. I was an agent, and I was deployed to Saudi Arabia, and I'm looking at one of the first books about remote viewing. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, this is the stuff he told me about 10 years ago. And to tell the rest of the story, he retired in the late 90s, around 99, 2000, with 44 years in the intelligence community. He had started out in Army Special Forces. He was 101st Airborne, then Special Forces, and then was brought into the intelligence world. And he was my professional mentor, as well as my esoteric spiritual mentor. He's the one that kind of guided me on my national security career and opened doors for me and stuff like that. So it's an interesting combination there.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. And was he pretty, did he pretty much share with you a lot of things that he discovered along the way? You know, when he talked about remote viewing, was he actually in that program or just knew about it?
Well, as the years progressed and I got into my own career and, you know, positions required security clearances and stuff, and I got my own, I learned that the capacity in which he worked would have put him in, kind of the sphere of awareness of that program going on, because they would have used the remote viewing unit. They would have been a customer of the remote viewing unit, as it were, right? They would have gone to these guys and said, hey, we need to know this, we need to know that. So, yeah, he would have known about it.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. And, you know, for all those different programs, there was all different types of things they were exploring, you know, in that whole mm-hmm. realm. Mm-hmm. And I know one of them was actually, I think, drugs, LSD too, was that involved in that whole?
Well, I know that drugs, you know, psychotropic drugs and LSD and such, hallucinogenics, were used in MK Ultra.
Oh, that's indeed. What I'm thinking of. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think they were used in remote viewing. I'm sure somebody out there has combined the two.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I wasn't thinking about combining. I was just thinking about all the different things they were involved in, you know, that is just hard to believe that they were experimenting in so many different things. So as far as the UFOs go, have you personally ever had a sighting yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in December of 2014.
Well, let's hear about it.
Yeah. Well, one of my kids lives here at the house, and her boyfriend lives with us 4 days of the week. He's a chef. He manages a restaurant out in another town, so he comes in half the week. And he was coming in late at night from work, and came in the house. He said, "Walter, come out here and look at this thing over the house." So, you know, he's into UFOs, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to see, you know, a little satellite blipping way up high. So I come out, turn, and I look up, and my jaw drops. Yeah. I'm like, I can't say what I said, but it's like, oh man. So I said, you stay here. I ran in the house, got my camera, came out with the camera. The thing was still there, and I started filming it. Now, what we saw was maybe 70 feet above the house. It was kind of in an area where it was between my house and my neighbor's house. And the night was interesting. It was one of those kind of low overcast nights where you were clear up to the low ceiling of the yep. bottom of the clouds there, mm-hmm. the mist. And this thing was below that. So that was probably about maybe 90 feet, you know, the ceiling of that. This thing was below that, and it was just staying in one place, okay? Mm. And there was a rotating luminescence inside. Okay, some source of dynamic light that was rotating. The light provided the shape, the visible shape, and that was something. It was flat bottom underneath the where you could see the illumination coming up, and a dome shape covering, like almost there was a half dome or half spherical kind of cover, right? Clear mm. cover or whatever over whatever this luminescence was. And it stayed there long enough for me to get a couple of seconds on the camera trigger there. And then it started moving, not erratically, not like it was the wind carrying it, but very smoothly, very lateral like that, like it was under some type of control. Hmm. And it moved slowly. And then it started dumping over the side this molten substance.
Really?
It was just almost, yeah, white hot, just burning white hot. And it, you know, it did a couple of heavy dumps of this stuff, you know, a couple of lighter dumps, and then it, you know, continued moving. And then it eventually kind of got lost in the overcast and disappeared into the mist and the fog. And he told me that when he was driving from the freeway exit to our house is almost exactly a mile. And he got off the freeway, and as he was on the road heading, you know, the remaining probably three quarters of a mile to the house, he saw this thing moving essentially from the northwest of our location in a southeastern trajectory. And it was ahead of him as he was getting to the house. And then he saw it stop above the house, and he thought, wow, that looks like it's right over our street. And as he got close to the house, he realized, holy smokes, this thing's, you know, right there over the house. And that's when he came in to get me.
Wow.
And you know the rest of the story. Now what's really interesting is the video and the still images, all you see is a light, and when you see it dumping the stuff, it's just like, you know, just, you know, little it's like lights that you can't quite get in focus.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, leave it to the cameras these days, it looks farther away than it was to our eye. And we both, I said, okay, you know, describe this thing to me. What are you seeing before I see anything? Because I wanted to make sure he was seeing the same thing I was seeing, because there's been instances of, you know, two people can look at something and maybe they're seeing different things. And the bit with, you know, what it looks like in the stills and in the film doesn't look like what we saw with all the detail. So that was, you know, it was about 11:30 at night. And, you know, that's it. I didn't talk about it for, my gosh, 3 years. I didn't talk about it with really anybody except close friends.
Yeah.
And wow. But there that, it is.
That's a good one. Also, you're probably aware of Charles Haltz, you know, talking about in the Rendlesham Forest about that eye-shaped, you know, it looked like an eyeball sort of bouncing through the woods between the trees, and then it started dripping the molten liquid from it, which is really fascinating. And I asked him, you know, did he actually try to find any of that? And they did. They tried to find it, but they couldn't find any. How about
what
you?
What I found, what I found the next day was a charcoal-y substance that was so light that it pretty much virtually disintegrated after I was, you know, I handled it with a object. And, you know, as I was examining it, it didn't last very long at all. That was in the yard. And then I found this stuff, a couple more samples of it, as I followed the trajectory of it through my neighborhood. And it was interesting.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. I tried to save some of it, but it just
dissipated or whatever.
Yeah.
And why did it take 3 years for you to talk about it? Since you also have an interest in UFOs.
Because number one, I do not think one of the reasons. I don't think it was, I do not believe at all that it was extraterrestrial related. I figured that it's possible because I live, you can see the former Norton Air Force Base from where I live. And that's another discussion, but I'm pretty sure there's probably still some type of military presence there. It would make sense to me coming from my perspective, being an Air Force officer, former OSI agent. So there is the possibility that it could have been something related to the Air Force Base. I have to throw that out there. But the rest of it, with my analysis, appeared to be enough of a personally relatable thing, even with the witness there with me, that I just didn't feel compelled to really talk about it publicly.
Sure,
it took me a while to really get comfortable with talking about it.
Well, you know, I'm exactly the same way. I had a sighting in 2006, and I didn't talk about it. You know, I mean, I talked about it on a comedy show, and basically, it spawned the idea of this show. It's kind of a long story, but that's how that all happened. I hadn't talked about it.
Well, you know, another part of it is that, doing what I do, and you know, I was already out there as a nonfiction writer and a commentator on UFOs and stuff. I decided that if I was going to talk about it, I was going to talk about it where I would tell it freely, that I wouldn't bank on it. And, oh, gee, I had a UFO experience. So, wow, I could write a book or five books about this and get on the circuit and get paid. I'm like, no, I wasn't comfortable doing that. So I decided, well, you know, if I'll talk about it, I'll just talk about it freely in interviews. And, you know, there it is. Take it or leave it, mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. We're going to be taking calls here in a little bit, and I do want to tell people a couple things here in just like 5 minutes or so. I want to tell the audience that this is going to be a new number. The old number, of course, will still work for now, but we actually have we're going to have them screened. Race will be screening these calls, and the new number will come up in YouTube. And I will let that know. I will announce that too as far as so it can get over at KGRA Radio at the same time. But we will be taking calls in like 5 minutes or so. But before we do that, I wanted you to, if you would, talk about your dad's weird, as you put it, I think you said weird Air Force experience. Let's hear about that.
Now, this I have written a book about.
Okay.
Because it involves my, you know, extensive analysis and hypotheses and speculations regarding this story that my dad told for, you know, over 35 years before he died. And, well, I first heard it in 1974 when I was about 10 years old. And essentially, my dad was a physiological training instructor in the U.S. Air Force in the mid-late 50s. And essentially, he and the guys at his unit ran the altitude chamber at George Air Force Base here in Victorville, California. Now, that put him in the Aerospace Medicine Command of the Air Force. He was on an actual honest-to-goodness aircraft crash retrieval team. I've got the document. It's in the book as part of his duties. It doesn't say UFO crash retrieval or alien crash. You know, they, when there were crashes, they had to go retrieve the remains, if it was a fatality and such, and the pieces of the aircraft. And he was on one of those. That was kind of an additional duty of his that he was on. Basically, this is the story he told since 1974. He was in training in 1958 at Gunter Air Force Base in Alabama, and he and a couple of the other guys were told they had to go over to Texas to Randolph Air Force Base, which was another aerospace medicine focused base. And they get on the plane and they're flying west out of Alabama, out of Montgomery, and the plane over Mississippi takes a northward banking turn, levels off, and an intelligence officer, a guy comes out of the front forward cabin, introduces himself as an intelligence officer, and explains that they're going to Wright-Patterson. And they go to Wright-Patterson, and they're briefed in on a crash that happened in New Mexico in 1947, essentially, you know, what we know as Roswell. And they were told that this had happened again. The situation had happened again out in Arizona, and that's where he and the guys he was with were going to be sent to be part of a rescue operation, because apparently the pilot was alive and his people requested the assistance, or, you know, our assistance to rescue the pilot and bring him back. Now, my dad says he was told that this was the pilot and craft of another civilization separate from ours that coexists with us on this planet and such. And for years, he swore that Roswell was not an extraterrestrial incident. And the bodies, you know, that he saw and was briefed on were just as human as us, but just with less hair. Body hair was the way he described them. And
time travelers.
Well, you know, the who knows? Yeah. So he told this story, and, you know, I found it fascinating. My whole life I'm hearing this. And finally, a few years after he passed away, I thought, you know what? I've been writing, researching, investigating. I've had my career. I'm an Air Force officer, and you know, I've learned some things. And I think it's time that I really sat down and researched and investigated this story my dad told me, and look at the historical context. And what I, when I did, what I found out was that the U.S. Air Force Aerospace Medicine Division was intimately involved in the quest to put man in space, which really started in the 1920s and 30s with Colonel Harry Armstrong of the Army Air Corps, and then continued after the war and all through the 50s with Otis Benson, the Air Force commander of the Aerospace Medical Division, which my dad, his specialty, fell under. What I also learned was that the of the four military branches that engaged in experimental MK Ultra operations during the 50s, the U.S. Air Force in particular really liked MK Ultra, and they started their own MK Ultra, you know, little program. Okay, and this was in the 50s, and as we know, in MK Ultra, there is the psychological technology of the planted narrative, laying over a false narrative in the psyche of a person to perhaps suppress actual activities. And when I looked at that and the context, you know, of that history, and it was the Cold War, and there indeed was actually classified manned space program research and stuff going on in the 50s with the Air Force, it occurred to me that it's possible that the story my dad told of this coexisting civilization and such and on may have been a planted narrative to cover for whatever he was actually doing while in Arizona during, right, you know, this period of time. And so I felt that if I was going to write a book about my dad, you know, present my dad's story, I felt that it would be, it had to be fair and objective of me to also present this context that, hey, MK Ultra was going on and the U.S. Air Force loved it, specifically the command my dad was in. So it is possible, I have to recognize that it's possible that the story my dad superficially believed, or believed, I'll say the story he believed, may have been a planted narrative. And that's one of the hypotheses in that book. About that. So it's interesting, you know, still his story as he told it could be true.
Now, sure. And what about as far as them telling him anything like you can't talk about this, or signing a non-disclosure, anything like that happened?
I'm you know, he would say that, you know, through the years that I could tell he was stopping at a certain point, and you know, it was clear that he couldn't talk about some details. But you know, of course, and then when I got into the Air Force and or the FBI, then the Air Force, and I learned how these things work because I have a fairly decent security clearance myself. You know, I understand how these things work, and it's my speculation, my opinion, that what the Air Force was doing with MK Ultra back then was possibly experimenting with it as a means to keep people from talking about classified operations, which would hypothetically explain putting a narrative about, you know, another civilization and UFOs. Say, for instance, he was working on the actual classified human space travel research, okay, or actual classified human space program that the Air Force was conducting, for example, and that was the thing they were trying to keep deeply classified. Well, for example, the hypothetical I lay out in the book is that when he agrees to do whatever work it was he did, he agrees to being subjected to MK Ultra methods when his assignment is over to cover over memories of the actual classified operation with a planted narrative. And I hypothetically propose that he would have agreed to this because back then MK Ultra was a new toy. You know, they, you know, weren't sure of all the bad things that could happen. And, you know, he's a young patriotic guy. He would have said, yeah, sure, count me in. And that's how theoretically they would have experimented with ways of keeping something secret, is using this planted narrative thing to, you know, keep it suppressed. But after a while, it breaks down over the years, and it did affect, you know, his psycho-emotional moods and things like that over the years. So,
Wow. Now, I do want to say I did put up the new number up on YouTube, and I just realized, just as I was going to announce this just a second ago, that there is some settings that I'd have to really work out and test this. We had put this number up just before the show went live. Not going to be able to use it right now, this time in this show, only because I do not believe that my browser will feed back through. It's a long story. Don't want to get into the technicality of it, just the fact that I don't think it's going to work. So in that case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put up the normal call number, which is 603-967-4030. If someone would like to call in that number, they can call in now. And we'll get that all ironed out by next week. We'll figure out how to get that number working well next week. So, pardon me. So I remember when you and I were talking ahead of the show, you said you had a thought that a lot of the UFOs, or 90% of them, are military. So how do you come across that conclusion, especially with the sighting you had? How could you possibly explain that? Why would something be dumping molten stuff over if it was military?
Actually, I think that's a reasonable possibility, because depending upon whatever technology might have been tested or in the thing, my view that 90%, that's just my personal number, okay? That's not a hard law. But roughly 90%, in my opinion, of the legitimate UFO sightings, you know, that not just people making stuff up to get attention, are some form of classified human technology. A chunk of it military, another chunk of it would be, you know, private aerospace development, you know, proprietary technology of theirs, or even possibly other organizations that we have come to popularly call breakaway civilizations, perhaps. But classified human technology, something that human organizations, agencies are doing. And the remaining 10%, in my opinion, would include the otherworldly possibilities, people from other planets. You know, you could throw interdimensionals in there, what have you, the time travel thing or whatever. But a lot of people get alarmed when they go, oh, 90%, how can you say that? Well, I point them to the 10%. MUFON, for example, just one organization, in the month of April of this year, reported over 5,000 UFO sightings that were reported, you know, just in that given month, okay, around the world to them. Now, 10% of that would be over 500 UFO sightings that I would reasonably say, well, those, you know, those would be the otherworldly ones. Well, I mean, over 500 otherworldly UFO sightings in a given month is a lot. Because remember, it only takes one to, you know, prove, so to speak, that people come from other worlds. So that 10% is still a big, giant, fat number of possibility. Now, why do I say 90? It's because we know that we have militaries, ours and others around the world. We know that aerospace companies exist. We know that they're always testing and developing things. That's a fact. That's a given. And I think a lot of times, you know, people will see something and the excitement maybe exaggerates what they think they're seeing, or maybe what they're seeing is some pretty amazing technology that due to their just simple, you know, lack of awareness, because they're not exposed to it, they're not privy to it, it seems otherworldly to them. But
I get it.
That's where I come to that. And also, you know, having been in the Air Force, I was an OSI agent that was, I was chief of a counter-espionage operations branch, okay? That's double agents. And we work with classified technology information daily, okay? So I saw a lot of interesting things across my desk. I saw interesting things when I had to go to vaults. I have a pretty, you know, good security clearance, so I was, you know, briefed on stuff. And so I, you know, all of that is how I come to the 90% number.
I got it. And it's different. You laid it out differently than I thought you were going to. So I'm not going to be able to argue with you as much as I wanted to. we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where are you calling from?
Hey, this is James from Canada.
Hey, James, welcome to the show. You have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. Hi, Mr. Bosley. Nice to speak with you. I'm a big fan of your work and especially your skeptical criticism of the whole TTSA scenario.
Yes.
And your work with dark journalists is a guilty pleasure of mine, especially in Twitter land where we're surrounded by young guns and true believers. So what I wanted to get your thoughts on is just the general scenario that we're dealing with. I try to remain skeptical and open-minded. And, you know, I've tried to talk to some friends who work in intelligence just to get a feel of what are the bounds of U.S. intelligence to be able to run some sort of operation like this that is not what they're saying it is, right? So this is not disclosure. This is not an acclimatization confirmation program. This is, you know, misinformation for adversaries or whatever. It, to me, I was never able to wrap my mind around an alternative that wasn't more outrageous than just going with what they were saying. So I was wondering the lens through which you see this and sort of what you think the bounds are of, A, what they're capable of doing and what they're legally allowed to.
I think I understand what you're asking. Well, first of all, when an organization or a program wants to divert, okay, focus from what something really may be or really is, and they want to divert the perception of that, well, they can use whatever information that they want that will reasonably work within the context of that particular operation. Information is not in itself something that they really have to worry about in this context, that they have to worry about, you know, legalities. As far as the UFO, so to speak, for actual human technology, a lot of that is done by the UFO community and UFO media community itself. It's really a lot of, hey, people are seeing this thing. Well, okay. And they think it's from another planet. Well, let them continue to think that. Just keep feeding that. Yeah, 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 that sounds good. Yeah, we don't know what it is. So, you know, kind of a wink and a nudge. Go ahead and think it's from another world. That kind of does the job for us. Now, when you're asking what do you mean, what's illegal, to what extent, I'm not sure.
So let me give you an example, right? Like, I think if you follow what I call core Tom DeLonge canon, which is 2016 to 2017, probably 9 hours of radio, his big gestalt on the secrets of the universe, which was given to him by his various contacts, right? And, you know, and some degree of that now has gone straight through the mainstream press, the international press. My mom asked me about it, right? So it's not just UFO town now. It's full mainstream public consciousness. So that's what I was trying to get my head around.
Yeah, to an extent. It's not as gripping to the general mainstream as our community, elements of our community think it is or are insisting that it is. There's still a lot of people out there that are like, huh, what? But yeah, you're right. It is. It's out there a little bit more, a little bit farther. Look, when it comes to perception management, I don't want to say the sky's the limit, but you do have margin because you're doing just that. You're managing perceptions. Your job is to deflect an understanding of what something actually is. So, you know, you have to get creative. Now, When I talk about perception management relative to something like TTSA, that's something within, in my opinion, the CIA context and the CIA PSYOPs context. And wow, their purpose for being involved in all this could be anything. What I see as far as a sleight of hand going on with any of this and what they do is simply that, and I'm not the first to say this, there's been others have been talking about this, and I agree with it. It appears that we might be ready to see a pretty big leap forward in these technologies, and somebody may want to be getting out there ahead to kind of pave the perception management road to lead in a certain direction, if that makes, you know, sense. Remember, I don't know exactly what it is they're up to, but my experience as a former spook, as an investigator, as a researcher, my hackles are up, my radar's up, okay? I know right. that there's something up here. It's not exactly what it appears to be, but I can't tell you exactly what that is yet. I can only tell you, this looks and sounds like a duck, you know?
Sure.
So, if that helps.
That's great. Thank you very much. I'll stay skeptical.
All right. James, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
So I'm interested in continuing this conversation, actually.
Sure.
One of the things I said on a show, I was kind of surprised I didn't get any, you know, feedback or hate mail like I often do. But I just said, you know, if there was going to be a misinformation agent, Lou Elizondo is a perfect guy for it because he's really smooth. He's very, you talk to him, you know, face to face, you trust the guy immediately. I mean, I'm this is how I feel when I talk to him. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought, wow, you know, in actuality, he would be a really good misinformation agent. I'm not saying he is. I'm not saying he isn't. But I will say that, it is curious because there are people that are speculating. And I thought it was a really good thing that actually on Unidentified, in one of the episodes, they actually tackled that very subject, you know, of whether he is or is not. And, you know, for, you know, maybe that's all part of the plan. Like to say if he was misinformation, maybe that, you know, to go along with, well, you're right. You know, I understand why people think that. And I would never do this that, you know, I don't know if you watched that particular episode or not.
I think I've watched only four or five episodes so far. I think that was number four
where he was talking about that. So I don't know.
Maybe I glossed over that.
I
watched them up to the point that my friend Greg Bishop was on there.
I got to pick up after the episode
he was on.
So. I got to tease him next time I see him about that because it said underneath him, UFO expert. I love that.
You know, it's interesting you'd say that they addressed that, and the way they addressed it was he assured the viewer that he was not.
You know, basically that came up like, you know, he would, you know, basically never do that. He understands why, you know, there is controversy and people are, you know, questioning him and stuff like that. You know, I mean.
It convinces me. All he had to do was say, gosh, I would never do that. But yeah, I'll have to watch it myself in all fairness. And like we were talking before about look at the body language, listen to the voice. I've talked about them plenty. So people tend to know where I come from on that.
Well, there's also at play out there, and I'm not saying this has anything to do with you or not, but at play out there is a lot of jealousy as far as, you know, Tom DeLonge making any headway when a lot of people have tried to make headway for so long. Mm-hmm. And he's actually opened a lot of doors. You know, maybe he's being used. You know, that's the other alternative. Maybe not. You know, and let me just ask you this question. Do you think that in time, if that is a situation that we'll eventually find out?
It's very, very possible in time to find out. I came to the conclusion that Tom DeLonge himself was sincere about his interests, sincere about his pursuits of this, and sincere in his vision of TTSA. The scenario I see is that when he approached the government folks, somebody there in the intel community said, we could really use this. Let's help this guy develop this thing. And let's be involved in this. That's the way I see it. So I think the casual way to put it is he's being used. It's been used to some degree. I would agree with that assessment.
Interesting. But what about when it comes to all these other people like Tim Mellon, Steve Justice, Hal Putoff, all those? Do you think they would actually get in bed with something like this and agree to go along?
Yes.
You do. And what would their motivation be?
Duty. They would see it as part of, you know, what they've done all along in their careers. They would see it. The people who would do this, see, their perspective is they're supporting national security directives. That's exactly how they would see it. If I were an agent in charge of the or involved with special projects in OSI, which is an actual division, and they protect all this secret technology, and, you know, they told me, hey, you know, Walter, let people think something's a flying saucer from another world if they see the stealth this or that drone or whatever. Absolutely. Okay, cool. Now, you can point to the Paul Benowitz situation and say, oh, bad, evil Air Force. But if you read, for instance, Greg Bishop's excellent book on this and you look closely, it's my opinion that the Air Force was not so culprit as another player. And that other player appears to be the NSA. Okay, it appears that the NSA was the organization behind really pushing Benowitz over the edge. Now, Doty, that comes up because, you know, being an OSI agent, people say, well, what about Richard Doty? When I was a new agent and, you know, they put me in counterintelligence stuff because that's what I had done for the FBI before OSI, Richard Doty was mentioned to me as a cautionary tale. You know, my supervisor said, look, we got to be careful with certain things, blah, blah, blah. There was this agent, Richard Doty, and, you know, essentially, we don't want anything like that happening again. That was blah, 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 so forth. So he was a cautionary tale to me. I never met the man. I've only spoken with him privately once, I think 2 years ago via Facebook direct message. But he was not, you know, he was not presented as the shining example of, you know, doing things right when I was in. Before I ever heard of him. This was in 94.
And what exactly were his issues where did he go wrong? Because there were other people involved, not just him.
Exactly. Yeah. There were other people involved. And I have said before that when I finally learned more from the public perspective and through, you know, Greg and more details on his book, when I get asked this, I say, look, in all fairness, on the other side of this coin, I've given you the one side I was told. But on the other side, after having been an OSI agent and been in the world that, you know, he and I were in, I tell people all the time, I'm not going to ultimately judge Richard Doty on the Benowitz affair until I get to see the case file. And until I see the case file, until any of us out here see the case file, we don't know even half of what the actual facts and details were. Okay, so really, you can't judge Richard Doty that harshly. All of us being ignorant of what's in that case file. That case file on all of that could have some stuff in it that would really enlighten people, and might even, in their own minds, exonerate, you know, the Air Force and implicate, you know, another organization, because we know there were other organizations involved. But you know, that's the one thing, you know, that people can point to as far as what we're talking about with perception management.
Right. Richard's going to be on the show either sometime in August or September. And I did ask him if there was anything I couldn't talk about, and he said, well, of course he can't talk about anything that's classified. I said, yes, of course.
Right.
But I said, I want to talk about the Paul Benowitz case? You know, let's talk about that. And mm-hmm. he said that he's fine. And so it should be an interesting show. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people wanting to ask questions on that. So when I set the date, I'll announce that. But it's probably sometime late August, early September, something like that. But yeah, you know, you see the situation where he gets involved, and you know, and Greg Bishop, I know, did write a wonderful book about it. Chris Lambright, who's a friend of mine, also wrote half of his book, X Descending, on the Paul Benowitz case. And it's a sad situation. You know, we have yes. talked about it on the show a number of times, but just the whole thing, I feel as though he was really, really used, Paul Benowitz was in general, just because he probably did see, I will agree with you, he probably did see military, you know, mm-hmm. experimental aircraft or just plain, you know.
Technology, some yeah. technology that they at the time just didn't want the people paying too much with any attention to it all.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing is unfortunate and tragic.
Yeah, and this goes back to the 1980s, I believe. Is that when?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so yeah. you think of it, you know, if they had this unusual technology all the way back then and the way technology grows and leaps and bounds, you know, who knows what they have out there. But I really don't believe, you know, when it comes to the Nimitz case and the Tic Tacs, I would have a very hard time believing that those were actually
really?
Our technology.
Really?
Just with all the everything that it did.
Really?
Yeah.
Not at all. Couldn't possibly be anything.
Well,
that
you think about the G forces and the right hand turns and things like that.
And
any
that
technology
would affect
human
that pilots, right?
What's that? I'm
that
not talking about
pilots, obviously.
I'm not talking. Yeah, but I'm not talking about what a pilot would take in a G force. Talking about the equipment itself, there's nothing that could really hold together that we have that we know
as far
about.
As you know,
as far as we know,
that we know about. See, yeah. But here's the thing. People, like, for instance, and I'm just analyzing, I'm not coming at you or anything, that clause at the end of your sentence, a lot of people will dismiss thinking about that, but that we know about is a huge fat margin of clause there, that that we don't know about that is a lot more important than a lot of folks really want to acknowledge or do acknowledge, you know, naturally. And that's the key, that we know about.
Okay.
You and I don't know that there's not some type of, you know, super metals, you know, that they've put together or super, what's the word? Not metals, but plastics.
The metamaterials?
Metamaterials.
Okay,
kind of
we only have a minute.
We don't know.
We only have a minute left, but I do want to make this point, though.
Uh-huh.
People have been seeing this type of technology for 50 years, and I don't think yeah. there's any way possible that we could have hidden something like that, or why we wouldn't use it in a war situation if we had that technology.
I've heard that in the first Gulf War, and I heard this when I was on active duty, that there was something that was deployed even before the stealth one, ahead of the stealth fighters, that was so bizarre to the enemy forces that saw it that it scared the hell out of them. It was something that was in flight, and I was never able to learn more details about that. So,
wow.
You know,
well, we are out of time. I hate to say it. We're out of time. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Sure.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
All right. All right. Take care now.
All right. You too.
All right. All right, everyone. So that is it for the show this evening. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, we'll be back with Michael Hall, interesting guest. And so stay tuned for that. And I want to thank everyone for listening. And everyone that helps out with the show, Alejandro, for helping us out with the news in the beginning, our guest, Ben Hansen, and, of course, Walter Bosley. That's it, and good night, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.